You're with Mike Ryan on today's News Talk Radio. TNT.
Well, it's the... What day is it? It's... Just joking. Anyway, it's getting closer to the end of the week, which we all want. We love. It's May 26, by the way, in Australia. If you're in England, it's still that date, and I think in the US and parts of the US, well, it's not that date at all. It would be the 25th, being a Thursday here and a Wednesday there. Now, I've got to tell you before we get into our next guest. I was talking to Patrick Henningsen this morning via Skype, and he sent me a clip, which is something that is very scary, to say the least. Anyone found breaching COVID rules in South Australia could be punished with 2 years jail as new laws are set to sail through state parliament this week.
And Andrea, the state government's proposed new COVID laws are copping criticism.
That's right, Jane. The new legislation is set to replace the Emergency Management Act, responsible for rules like mandatory quarantine and mask wearing. But the alternative bill could face some pushback in the upper house. The Law Society says it lacks detail and would hand the governor extraordinary permanent powers. Leaked documents have reportedly revealed the Liberal Party's worried about hefty penalties of up to $75,000 and a 2-year jail term planned for any future COVID breaches. The Shadow Cabinet is meeting tonight to go over what's proposed with a fine-tooth comb. It says while it supports a move out of the emergency declaration, it won't just be a tick and flick situation. So there could be some fiery scenes in Parliament when it resumes tomorrow.
Yeah, and in fact, the state opposition there said a dark age dictatorship is on its way. It said the bill includes tough penalties of jail time or a fine or both of $75,000. That's $75,000. And the South Australian Labor government have been blessed with some support from the Greens and SA Best. This was the press conference.
Claims that you're in the dark age running a dictatorship with some of the hefty penalties in the new COVID legislation.
Sort of smacks of desperation a little bit, I think it's fair to say. Look, we're committed to getting this COVID legislation through because what we want to do is come out of the emergency management declaration that's been in place now for over 2 years, where we've had one person in South Australia be able to make any direction without oversight, and that's done and served us well in the past. And I want to thank Grant Stevens for his extraordinary contribution in conjunction with Nicola Spirier. But clearly at some point we have to move away from a situation where one person in the form of the state coordinator has, you know, an extraordinary amount of authority to returning towards government with appropriate parliamentary oversight, which is what we're working towards. So in many ways, it's the complete opposite of what Mr. Spears has been suggesting. But they're desperate to make a political point, and that's their prerogative.
Is there any chance that there might be some movement on the maximum penalty? That appears to be one of the great issues.
Well, we've got the support to get the legislation through, but let's just put some things in context to this. So what we're actually doing here is moving away from harsh restrictions that have been in place in the community and on the economy. What we've been doing since we've come to government is investing additional resources in health so we can relieve restrictions, put less burden on business and people living within our society. And I think we've achieved that relatively effectively. Now we're moving into the next stage of the management of the pandemic, where we want to move away from one person being in charge to returning to a more practical application of government in a parliamentary democracy. So this is about relieving people of restrictions and burdens rather than the opposite. And when you think about the penalties question, there ain't going to be too many things that penalties can be applied for, because we've got rid of restrictions. See, by getting rid of so many restrictions, the need to impose penalties dramatically reduced.
Now, that guy's a nut. He's truly loving the feel of power. Labor Party there. Labor Party in Victoria. Their elections this year, towards the end of it, they'll win. There is no opposition there. The LNP is pathetic. Now, Queensland, I mean, Palaszczuk has got no opposition, so she'll be here till the cows come home. WA, they love to be locked down, smacked, whipped and spanked, all that sort of stuff, because McGowan is loved. So we have, and federally, we have the state, or they have the Labor Party, and, well, they're just, they're going to rule the country with the iron rod. And as Patrick said, though, this is like all the children from the village of the damned. They all grew up and went into politics. Remember that film, that terrible film? There's two, actually. One in 1960 and one in, I think, 95. And they had those funny eyes, you know, they can make planes drop out of the sky and all that sort of stuff. And yeah, something like, we won't be beaten.
At precisely 10 a.m., in a quiet seaside village, something happened. Something unexplainable. Something unbelievable.
There's a lot of pregnancies, much more than would normally be expected. All the pregnancies seem to date from the day of the blackout.
Oh, no.
Now, this town is about to discover that looks can kill.
There have been a few casualties. I should say, accidents. That might be related to contact with the children.
My daughter was involved. Who are they?
They have one mind that they share between them.
Father?
Let us pray.
You've been discussing us with Dr. Vachney. What did she tell you? You're hiding something.
The police can't do anything to stop the children.
Get out while you can.
Something so much more powerful than we'll ever be.
What are you gonna do?
The only thing that we can do.
You can't stop us, you know. Don't try.
The children from the village of the dam grew up and went into politics. Be afraid. Be very afraid.
Now the world is damned.
It is indeed. And that's what's happening to the world. If you look at the US, Biden made the tragedy yesterday a political statement. He wanted to bring America together. Remember at the start of his residency in the White House? Anyway, that didn't happen. We have Albanese. He says he wants to do the same. As my neighbour would say once, politely she would say, that's bull. And something else attached to it. So I think the world is in a really bad spot at the moment.
Your trusted news source.
Something you just can't question.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Natural immunity has almost become a dirty word in this world of pandemics and vaccines. Now, this surely is a backward step and shows how much our public health authorities have been corrupted by Big Pharma. Just look at the way they approach COVID-19, keeping people locked up in isolation and disregarding the importance of basic vitamins and minerals in early treatment. I could think of the cheapest mineral would have been, or vitamin would have been, vitamin D. And if you look above you, if you haven't got clouds, you'll see the sun. But now you've got to stay inside, keep locked up with those LED lights and Netflix. Now, hope is at hand with doctors such as Sabine Hizan, who has been forging ahead with her research on the gut and the relationship between the microbiome, good health and disease. Dr. Sabine Hizan is a pioneer in the medical field and the first woman ever accepted into the University of Florida as a clinical gastroenterology fellow. Dr. Hizan is the CEO of Ventura Clinical Trials, a leading research group for the microbiome and gut bacteria. She also is the CEO of ProGenobiome, which looks beyond the traditional protocols to treat bacteria and viruses with drugs and investigates the role of the gut microbiome. Dr. Hazan has received multiple awards for her research. My other guest is a regular guest, which you're all familiar with. That's TNT Radio's John Parsons, who describes himself as an undereducated biologist who has been involved in science research projects since 1995. John is an avid researcher on all things COVID and keeps us up to date on the latest news, speaking the common language, makes English very easy to understand instead of sometimes the waffle that comes out of scientists' mouths. First of all, Sabine, thanks for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And John, thank you for joining us.
Great to be here, mate.
Sabine, could you tell us about, now it's right, it's the microbiome, and what aspects of the body are we talking about? Is it just the gut or the whole digestive tract?
Well, I mean, the microbiome extends, when you look at the microbiome, it's really microbes, and it's microbes around us, microbes in our blood, microbes in our liver, microbes in our colon, in our mouths, in our, you know, small bowels. So it's really all, you know, a conglomeration of microbes and how they correlate and how they live together in symbiosis or dysbiosis, which is kind of an imbalance. So my focus is obviously on the bacteria that's in the colon, mainly because I do fecal transplant where I take healthy donor stools and I put it into unhealthy donors to try to understand how do we change disease. For example, a patient with Alzheimer's who had C. diff, I put a wife's microbiome, her poop, into his colon and he started remembering his daughter's date of birth. So that was the beginning for me of what did I do? What is going on in the microbiome that when I changed the microbiome of this individual, his memory started coming? And of course, this is the beginning of it, right? So my path was really understanding what am I seeing clinically when I attain an improvement in Crohn's disease or I attain an improvement in Alzheimer's? What am I seeing in the microbiome space at the genetic level? So my focus is really the gut, the colon.
How did you become an expert in this area?
Well, it was kind of serendipitous, really. I mean, I started, you know, my husband will tell you, if you want me to do anything, you just have to challenge me. And, you know, as a woman in a field, you know, people told me at University of Florida or in my when I was in residency, they didn't take women in GI. And I said, well, I'm going to be your first one then. And so that was the first challenge. And then it was like one thing after another. Oh, we don't take women in private practice. So I said, well, I'm going to open my own private practice. See you later. And then it was, and then, you know, again, more and more challenges and became in clinical research known as the queen of C. diff, which is a little bacteria that basically causes diarrhea and causes a lot of deaths. And I was recruiting for pharma for clinical trials for C. diff. When I couldn't fix the patients with the clinical trial at hand, which was cleaner than doing fecal transplant, I would do fecal transplant and use donors and basically attain cures in C. diff. So I became known for C. diff. When fecal transplant became a capsule of poop in a pharmaceutical product, and I started seeing on my desk clinical trials from Korea with poop from Korea and poop from China in a capsule. You know, I said to myself, we're in the microbiome business and we don't even know what the hell we're doing. Mm. And so I started investigating. I said, well, what am I doing when I do fecal transplant and C. diff? It wasn't good enough for me to just achieve improvement. I wanted to understand this science. And if you look at fecal transplant, it was, you know, from the 5th century Chinese, they used to call it the yellow pea soup to treat cholera. So there's a lot of, you know, wisdom there. And my interest was, well, we have the technology now, genetic sequencing, the, you know, abilities to look at these microbes, to look at the fingerprint of a microbiome, to look at the genetics of C. diff. Surely we can understand what is happening to the microbiome when we fix C. diff with a new microbe. And, you know, I'm an avid gardener. And so to me, the microbiome and fecal transplant was really like gardening, right? You've got your compost And, you know, John, I know, is loving this because I'm getting us right into the gardening. But you've got your compost, right? What are we doing when we're composting, right? We're putting green herbs, and then we're putting all the bacteria from foods that are basically mildewed, and we're mixing all that, and we're expecting the bacteria to eat that green mulch and turn it into this amazing nourishment for the ground, right? Mm-hmm. And any good gardener will tell you, you need good microbes in order to grow beautiful tomatoes, in order to grow beautiful fruits and vegetables. So really, if the soil is not healthy, you know, you're going nowhere. So with C. diff, it was the same principle that I used as gardening, in that C. diff is essentially a bacteria that's overcrowded the ground, and it's like a weed, right? It's weeds all over the ground. And essentially, you have to take off the weeds. So that's how I tell my patients. I say, I have to get rid of all the toxins and the Clostridium. And then I turn the earth or clean the colon. And then I implant new seeds, right? New microbes. And then you wait for the microbiome to kind of grow. So it's very much like gardening in a way. So we have to start thinking like that, because, you know, the planet, the microbes, is just exactly the same thing as what's going on in our bodies. Mm. We tend to think as human beings that we're just here, but there's such a bigger picture here, which is the microbiome of humanity and the microbiome of the planet. The microbes are all around us, and they're guiding us, and they're directing, you know, our survival, our evolution. So this is very important field. So for me, it was a natural progression to go from clinical trials to opening my own genetic sequencing lab. I had to open it. Well, first, you know, I was challenged. Two scientists said, there's no need for you to look at the microbiome. We've already looked at it before and after fecal transplant. I said, oh, two pairs of eyes are going to figure out all of the trillions of bacteria. Well, then I'm going into it. Mm. And so I did it with a different approach, which was really, let me look at the microbiome as a clinical trial, and let me understand the microbiome as a clinical trial in every diseases. So in other words, what is happening in Alzheimer's? What is happening in autism? What is happening in Parkinson's? And then from there, you know, when COVID hit, I wanted to look and search for COVID, because I said, well, I bet you if I find COVID in the stools, because what most people don't realize is that every microbe that is on your skin, in your nose, ends up in the gut. You know, every microbes that you've inherited from your mom, from that you've traveled to Japan, you end up eating those microbes and they stay in your gut, right? So there is a fingerprint microbiome that exists in people. And so that was my discovery, to kind of see the microbiome in full motion and realizing, well, we can't really, you know, in autism say it's this bug or this bug, because it's multiple bugs that can cause the same problem. Same thing with Crohn's disease. Mm. You know, yes, it could be mycobacteria paratuberculosis. Yes, it could be Yersinia enterolytica. Yes, it could be Malassezia furfur. Yes, it could be all of those, because it's really in the microbiome space, its action leads to a reaction. So if that action is you got MAP because you ate, you know, some infected beef, or you drank some milk that had mycobacteria paratuberculosis, then that's going to start an action leading to a reaction, which is an overgrowth in a way of mycobacteria paratuberculosis and creating problems that could potentially be the cause of Crohn's for that patient. Mm. And therefore, treatment with antibiotics might be the first thing, but then you're going to need to repopulate the gut because you've now destroyed the gut with the microbes. So the microbiome is fascinating. I mean, I could talk forever. And so I'm going to let you ask questions, because my husband always says, you're talking, and you're not letting me speak.
I know, it's fascinating. But I'm curious, tell us about it sounds awful, but because you're a medical professional, nothing is awful. But tell us about, I think you call it a fecal transplant.
Yeah, so fecal transplant is disgusting. I'm going to be the first one to say it. My friend Neil Stolman, 25 years ago, said the future was in poop. And I said to him, I'm going into GI to do colonoscopies on clean colons. If you make me play with poop, I'm going to hate you. And sure enough, you know, a friend about 17 years, 18 years ago, I forgot, you know, time flies. A physician was dying of C. diff and nothing was working for him, not even clinical trials. And so I had to, you know, I called Neil and I said, so how do we do this exactly? He goes, you'll figure it out. And so, you know, it's basically taking poop from a healthy donor, putting it in a blender and then liquidifying it in a way, and then going via colonoscopy and inserting it all the way to the cecum after you've washed the colon and removed all the toxins and, of course, you know, gotten rid of C. diff to begin with. So it's not a very pleasant procedure. I wear a lot of Noxzema on my mask, but it is a procedure that's, you know, is showing some benefits. There's definitely a lot of work. We created actually the Malibu Microbiome Meeting with a bunch of doctors that we call the Biome Squad. And those are doctors from MD Anderson, Yale, Harvard, Mayo Clinic that are basically that all came and saw some interesting things with the with fecal transplant, you know, in cancer with Dr. Mimi Wang at MD Anderson. Dr. Sahil Khanna at Mayo Clinic found improvement of chronic urinary tract infections. Dr. Colleen Kelly at Brown University had two patients grow hair with alopecia areata from fecal transplant. So when you see this, you kind of say, I have to understand what's going on. Mm. We have to push the envelope to allow us to do this. And that's what I'm doing.
John, what tickled your fancy about all this? Because it's fairly, it's a subject that you wouldn't talk about over a beer. But you were very enthusiastic about all this because you love science and you dabble in it. What was your attraction to Sabine and what Sabine was doing?
Well, I had a fair idea about this very early. And then when I saw what Sabine was on about, I thought this ticks every box of my life experience that's got me into this question of what we're facing at the moment, which is the COVID thing. And the symbiotic scenario she talks about, the fact that we come in contact with bacteria and the garden scenario that she put forward, the soil types, the fact that we live in this pea soup world of all of these things, and also the association with minerals and how they can be affected either before or after or during. And if one bacteria does something to a mineral process or vice versa, that then flows onto the next bacteria. And we have all this acid and alkaline, and different bacteria can live at different levels throughout our gut, just like in the soil at different depths, just like around different soil scenarios and soil types. So, you know, it really hit me between the eyes that this is something positive. And there's so much negative about what we're facing at the moment. There's so much against us. We need something that we can say, this is positive. I can, as an individual, do something to prepare myself for the attack. It's a waste of time wearing a mask thinking you're not going to catch COVID. All of us are going to catch it. Mm. We've got to be internally and, I suppose, spiritually prepared for it. And the psychological aspects of this come into it as well. There's no question that what goes on inside us can change our thinking and the no placebo effect that we've talked about in the past. And the fact that the two greatest killers of COVID are obesity, you know, and anxiety. So if what we're doing by controlling our diet and giving us a positive feeling that we're losing weight and we're getting rid of that sugar out of our diet, we're taking a good complex diet mix and that's helping us, even by thinking it's helping us, it is helping us. So there's so many things in what she's doing that add a positive action to, instead of, you know, like pandemic response, as mentioned in that previous talk, you know, what a joke, having governments and ministers that know nothing to the level I know, let alone Sabine, and they're having a response. They just want to get out of the road of researchers like Sabine and allow her to take the steps that will or will not discover something, which is already on that track. And that's why I'm so wrapped in what she's doing. She's more than halfway down the road and she's right. I know she's right.
Look, we're chatting about things that you wouldn't talk about over a roast with Dr. Sabine Hazan and also, Hazan and also with John Parsons. Come back in a second. This is TNT Radio.
TNT Radio's Joseph Arthur.
Gregory Ridestone from the CO2 Coalition wrote a book called Inconvenient Facts. Facts Al Gore don't wanna know, no. Why are they lying to us? He says they're lying to us and went looking for the truth. Uncovered facts and figures, witch hunts came from the blame of climate change back in the 1400s, and there's witch hunts on our humanity today. Gregory Ridestone wrote a book called Inconvenient Facts. Gregory Ridestone from the CO2 Coalition is here with us now, a geologist, a scientist. Oh, welcome to the Friday Night Show.
Welcome, Gregory.
That was great. What a great, I have never had an introduction so great as that. That was excellent. Thank you.
That's your reward for being a freedom fighter, truth seeker, truth speaker.
Joseph Arthur and his Technicolor Dreamcast on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Nearly every day, we hear dire predictions about climate change from the media establishment, Hollywood, and politicians. They tell us that the world is coming to an end because normal human activity is raising the temperature to dangerous levels. To avoid a hellish apocalypse, they warn us we must immediately change our lifestyles and our very way of life. But are these sensational claims based on solid empirical science? Do the facts line up with the hype? Well, an increasing number of scientists are becoming skeptical. We covered what many of these scientists had to say in our first groundbreaking film, Climate Hustle. From overhyped claims about severe weather events, temperatures, rising sea levels, and even disappearing polar bears, Climate Hustle peeled back the hype and looked at the facts, facts that simply don't add up to any reason for alarm. So this begs the questions. Why would those claiming a global warming catastrophe spread a false narrative? What would motivate them? Why would they try to hustle you? Are they trying to control the climate or you? Well, those are the questions we're going to explore in this film. And the answers may shock you. Order your DVD, Blu-ray, or digital copy today of Climate Hustle 2.
To find out more, go to climatehustle2.com.
Hello. Hiya. So, what are we going to do with your hair today?
Oh, well, just a trim, thanks. You know, maybe an inch or two off, nothing fancy.
Okay, great. Now hold still!
Whatever you're doing, it's important to use the right tools for the job. So if you want to quit smoking, pick up a new and improved Quick Kit free from a local pharmacy. To find your nearest, text FREE and your postcode to 88088 or visit smokefree.nhs.uk. England only, two power sold while stocks last. Standard network charges apply.
News more twisted than soap operas and with worse actors. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
And my guest is Dr. Sabine Hazan and also John Parsons. Sabine, tell us about your recent book co-authored with the famous Aussie, Dr. Thomas Barodi and Shelley Ellsworth.
So am I allowed to say it on the radio?
You can say whatever you like.
So it's called Let's Talk Shit. I didn't call it Let's Talk Microbiome because I wanted to...
I love it.
I wanted to kind of simplify it to people so that they start paying attention to their microbes. You know, the microbiome, what we see as a log in the toilet is really trillions of bacteria all in balance to create a healthy individual or out of balance to create a disease. And I'm not going to spoil the last page, but I'm going to tell you the last page. The process of dying and going is, you know, when we talk about hope, and the reason for me it was so important to get into this field and to understand the microbiome is really because it gives me hope that I don't have to be scared of, you know, death, because the process of dying is really the bacteria in your colon taking over your body and putting you back into the earth. So really, if you think about it, those bacteria, those microbes go back into the earth and they're continuously living, you know. So we tend to think again of ourselves as human beings in this moment in time. But there's so much we don't know about the microbes of the planet. And that, to me, that's the fascinating adventure. You know, it's like being Indiana Jones and trying to understand, cracking the code on these microbes. So that's really, the book is an introduction to disease, digestion, the microbiome, fecal transplant. It's written with some, you know, funny twist to it, just to make it a little bit more digestible, if you want to put it that way. Because too often as scientists, it's very difficult to get the public to understand these very complex microbes. So if I say bifidobacteria, nobody's going to understand what I'm talking about. But if I say those are the good guys, you know, fighting with the bad guys, the E. coli and the Klebsiella, which really, even in the book, we kind of talk about there's no such thing as good guys and bad guys. It's all about the balance of the good bugs and the bad bugs. And that's what really the planet is all about. It's the balance. It's an ecosystem. It's the balance in our bodies. The one thing I learned that was fascinating through this discovery is how when you destroy a group, you know, in our guts, there's different continents. I like to call them like phylums, but they're continents of microbes. And if you destroy a whole continent, the human being is no longer healthy. He's lacking that continent of microbes that was sustaining his health. So same thing, you know, if you look at a larger picture at races, at humanity, every continent in the planet has its own culture, has its own foods, its own, you know, ecosystem in a way, its own climate. But look how beautiful the planet survives together with all these continents. Now, imagine you remove Africa. Well, the planet's going to be out of balance. It's not going to survive. So, you know, we have to start thinking of the planet as a whole, as humanity as a whole. That's the hope, in my opinion. Because once we stop looking into ourselves, our bodies, our life, our today living in this world for me, and we start thinking of the bigger picture, which is the planet, the unity, the diversity of human beings, then we start seeing the beauty of the planet and how the planet continues to survive, needing all those microbes of humans together, if you want to put it that way. So that's my philosophy.
Well, the book, I saw it and I had this gut feeling about it, that it was a pretty good one. So there you go. That's my bit of humor for the day. But what about some of the latest findings of the links between the microbiome and common diseases?
So, you know, we're seeing something. We're seeing something, you know, in autism. We're seeing something in Parkinson's. We're seeing something in Alzheimer's. Too early to tell. I will tell you of my latest publication, which, so we published in 2021 that we found COVID, SARS-CoV-2 in the stools, the whole genome of the virus. And we discovered that there were many mutations. And in fact, a lot of the patients have different mutations within a family. They all shared the same virus, but if you compared two different families, they had different viruses altogether. So that was an interesting finding. While we found SARS-CoV-2 in the stools, we also discovered that the people that had severe COVID had zero bifidobacteria in their gut. Bifidobacteria is the bacteria that's in your yogurt. It's the bacteria that has created a billion-dollar industry of probiotics. So it was important to look at it and to see how much bifidobacteria at baseline exists in the gut of severe COVID compared to people that have never gotten COVID in the same family. You hear of families of households where someone catches COVID and they're super sick, and then you see that the sister didn't catch COVID. What is the difference in their microbiome? Well, the difference is actually one microbe is the bifidobacteria. We discovered that those people that lived next to people that had COVID had a lot of bifidobacteria in their gut, a lot of Fascinobacterium prausnitzii, another bacteria, and essentially a lot of diversity, as opposed to people that had severe COVID that had very low Fascinobacterium prausnitzii, or very low or zero bifidobacteria. So that's an interesting finding, because I think that's going to become, you know, an interest for a lot of doctors to start paying attention to the bifidobacteria. Why is bifidobacteria so important? Because we're born with a lot of bifidobacteria. We have a lot of bifidobacteria as babies, and we die with zero. So the process of aging is loss of bifidobacteria. Why did I focus on bifidobacteria? Because I knew that. And I knew that the importance of that bacteria with relationships to probiotics. So, but also, if you look at disease, for example, and you look at obesity, obese patients have low bifidobacteria. Patients with Alzheimer's have low bifidobacteria. Mm. Parkinson's have low bifidobacteria. Even in autism, autistic kids, some of them have low bifidobacteria. So one has to ask the question, you know, is bifidobacteria the reason that so many people are dying? And, you know, the high-risk group in COVID is, if you think about it, are the people that are overweight, the aging population. Mm. So could it be that it's linked to their zero bifidobacteria in their gut? So that's to me, that's a very exciting paper that just came out in British Medical Journal. Mm-hmm. All our papers are on progenabiome.com. We have a publication. You know, we compared a lot of families. We compared, you know, siblings. One has Crohn's disease, got COVID. The other one, perfectly healthy, didn't have COVID. And the one that was perfectly healthy had a lot of bifidobacteria in his gut. So, you know, to me, that's the we need to start paying attention to the bifidobacteria, because unfortunately, if we are lacking bifidobacteria, and by the way, to talk about climate and to talk about plastic, you know, bifidobacteria decomposes plastic. So, and I don't think most people know this. So imagine if you're depleting your gut of bifidobacteria and the overall planet has less bifidobacteria, are we not then decomposing plastics anymore? You know, so there's an imbalance there, right? So I think we have to pay attention. More importantly than the lost microbes and the loss of bifidobacteria and how to get it back is, how did it get destroyed to begin with? Could it be that maybe we've overdone it with the cleansing? Maybe we've overdone it with the alcohol? Maybe we've overdone it with the pesticide? Maybe the answer is not in the germ theory that, you know, Bill Gates is so obsessed about, but maybe the answer is play in the garden, play with the microbes. You know, I inherited the work of Dr. Sidney Feingold. And remember, I'm the girl that didn't want to play with poop. And I'm the girl that basically super sterile. I would clean everything with, if a colon had poop, I would not even be in there, right? But I had allergies. I had a lot of allergies as a kid. I was given antibiotics as a kid. You know, and so with these allergies, as I started playing with the microbes, playing in my garden, playing with the microbiome and fecal transplant, you know, all of a sudden my allergies disappeared. All of a sudden I started feeling a lot better. So there's maybe something there, right? That maybe the sterile ways are not the way. Maybe putting your hands in Clorox and washing your clothes with Clorox is not the answer, because think about it. Every time you touch something, you put something on your skin, it gets absorbed in your blood vessels. Your blood vessels are traveling your whole body. Where does that all end up, the blood? It circulates to the bowels. So then all those chemicals, all those products that you're touching eventually touches your bowels, and you're starting to kill microbes, good microbes that could help you. So I think the whole sterility, we've gone a little bit overboard with that. I think there's a balance. I think we need to go back to the earth. We need to touch the earth. We need to be outside. We need to breathe. You know, there's microbes around us. The whole ecosystem, the whole planet is really, you know, geared to survive itself. You know, I always say humanity is probably going to disappear, but Mother Nature is always going to be there. You see after a fire, you see after a flood, you know, we went through the Woolsey fire in Malibu and my whole backyard burned to the ground, crisp. And then little by little, 3 months later, 6 months later, you see the planet reviving again. You know, if you go to a cemetery and you pay attention to the stones that have been there, you go to the New Orleans cemetery, you start seeing even though there's a coffin with a stone and a human being that was, you know, underneath the coffin, you start seeing life occurring again, plants growing on top of that stone, and eventually, you know, grass and life and all that is microbes, you know? So we have to pay attention to the planet, and we have to be symbiotic with the planet and less destructors and more building, more bringing. You know, C. diff was a bug that taught me a lot, because for 30 years, I tried to kill it with every single clinical trials and antibiotics. What I learned is that actually C. diff only occurs because you kill off the whole diversity of the microbiome around C. diff. So it's that little bug that basically is part of our microbiome. All of us have non-toxigenic C. diff in our gut. But once you start killing families after families with antibiotics, eventually you leave C. diff to start flourishing the gut. And then it's going to kill the host because of the fact that you've killed off all the families, all the microbiome around it. So that's my hypothesis anyways. That's what I've seen, because when I replant, when I put new diversity, a new microbiome, C. diff is all of a sudden quiet and doesn't cause any problems. And, you know, I've been treating C. diff for the last, you know, two decades almost. And I have to say, I went from killing that bug to realizing that bug doesn't need to be killed. It needs to be suppressed and given more bugs. So the idea of killing is not the answer. The answer is giving more microbes, less killing, more microbes. It's kind of like, you know, stop the hate, bring in the love. You know, it's like human beings. You surround human beings by happy people. They're happy. You keep them separated, miserable. They're suicidal. So it's not that hard. You know, we're just a reflection of a very primitive microbiome. So we just have to pay attention to what's going on in the invisible space.
What about the vaccines? You know, bad word for it, by the way, but what about the stuff they're throwing into us called a vaccine? How does that affect the bifida bacteria?
Well, that's a very good question, and the data is going to be coming. So I'm not going to spoil it, but we need to pay attention to the microbiome of the vaccines. Why? Because if you notice, when Omicron came, the vaccinated people started having Omicron. Why is that? Is it perhaps that Omicron is a natural virus fighting the unnatural virus that was created, or unnatural vaccine? Maybe.
Don't know about that one. It's I can't wait though to find out. I think the vaccines, as the more we, it's like, you know, the more we study things, the more we realize how little we really do know. And just from what you're doing, it's we're discovering things every week, aren't we? We're just saying, well, you know, what we thought isn't exactly the case as we thought it was. It's, you know, things change and knowledge changes. I mean, the discussion on science, you know, when they say the science is settled, it's never settled. Look, we'll come back to you in a second. We'll go to a commercial break. This is TNT Radio.
The midterms and America votes on November 8th. With his expert analysis and opinion, this is TNT Radio's Jeremy Beck.
The most recent GOP primary candidate endorsements didn't go completely to plan for former President Donald Trump. Of the 27 Trump-endorsed candidates across Alabama, Arkansas, Georgia, and the Texas runoffs, the vast majority won, but a few lost, which would be a significant blow for Trump. For instance, Trump-endorsed candidate for Georgia Governor David Perdue, who put up a challenge to current Governor Brian Kemp. But Kemp easily won with 74% of the vote. Perdue only managed to get 22%. Trump endorsed Perdue largely because he fought to overturn the 2020 presidential election result. Kemp did not. But the focus on this issue was not enough. Perhaps voters were not impressed that Perdue bought up to $260,000 worth of Pfizer stock in late February 2020, 1 week before the Trump administration publicly announced the deal with Pfizer. I'm Jeremy Beck for TNT Radio.
It's 4 a.m., Monday, and you're literally sucking baby snot through a tube because she's congested. Man, that's love. And if you love her that much, love her enough to make sure she's buckled in the right car seat. To make sure your child's in the right seat for their age and size, visit nhtsa.gov/the right seat. Show them you love them. Keep them safe. Visit nhtsa.gov/the right seat. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
Show me the studies.
Today's News Talk Radio.
True study. This is safe for adults, much less kids.
TNTRadio.live.
With Dr. Sabine Hazan and also John Parsons. John, how do we know that our microbiome is healthy?
Well, I think, from what Sabine said there, it's the best description I could have ever hoped for, and I'm sure it's people are getting it, even, because she's not your science. She's definitely talking on our language. But I could add that from the looking as a prime producer and an animal a lover, and just I've bred all sorts of animals, and I've had a few kids in my day, and I've brought up some kids and grandkids. It all makes complete sense. Everyone knows, get your kids out in the dirt, get them off the carpet, get them access to different foods, get them, exposed to all sorts of different environments, and when you, one of the things in animal kingdom in farming that's happening at the moment is in the Western Queensland, there's a lot of regrowth scrub happening, which is not edible, but camels eat it. And there's a lot of camels out there. So they've put water troughs for the cattle to eat, drink at, alongside the camels. The camels saliva into that water. They're passing the digestive bacteria that are used to and love eating the leaves of these woody plants. And the cows eat them, and then they can then eat and digest those plants, where before those trees or leaves were have no value nutrition to them. But if they can get the bacteria, and you actually inject cattle with stomach bacteria from different places to make them able to eat certain types of farmed plants so that they can digest them. So the bacteria in the stomachs of the cows is a good indication. Another great animal indicator that we're on the right track here is on the bottom of a cow's tail is a fluffy bit. It's called the swish. And the cow, goes to the toilet, spills a manure all over the tail, and then splashes it. Everyone thinks that's there to chase flies away. It's actually there to smack her udder with the manure that's come from her. And then the calf comes along, takes a suckle of the teat, gets some of that manure into its gut, and therefore it can, digest things that the cow's digesting. So there's plenty of examples in nature that show us we're on this right track. And the amount of saliva a calf uses produces when it suckles the teat. A cow has four stomachs, so its first stomach, the rumen, has to be of a certain bacterial process to start the digestion. Then they cough it up, so to speak, chew it in the mouth again, called the cud. Then it goes down to the second gut. So there's a whole process of digestion in the animal world and farming world that all of us who've had anything to do with them know about. And it's just so exactly what we're talking about right here from a practical, I can see that happening visual point. I also sent Sabine a letter from an astrobiologist I work with, Dr. Philippa Ewens, and she's found these what's called nanobes, which are bacteria, at 5 kilometres deep under the soil. So when we think of them as, and also it's obviously, this is a great, you've got a comment there about the Mars rock AL884001, which the big discussion about whether Mars is alive, and there was a discovery of deceased bacteria on this rock, but it was 200 times smaller than anything we'd seen here. But then when Philippa found her bacteria offshore Western Australia, 5 km down, suddenly in that rock sample was the living same bacteria. So they're obviously on Mars. They're obviously at 5 km deep here. They're obviously everywhere. They're universal is the only way to put it. And they're processing gases and minerals, and they're turning them into solids, which is where my research got involved in. So there's a complexity here that research has to follow up. And I'm of the opinion that what we're seeing is we'll accidentally trip over something if you have bacteria in your teeth, it can go down, and the wrong one can eat your heart valve. So there's a negative and a positive effect from these things, and we have to understand the symbiotics, and the symbiotics is so unusual. There's flora and fauna involved. There's, like I said earlier, there's one bacteria working, and if it doesn't do its job, the next bacteria can't do its job, and so on and so forth. So it's not just what one's doing, it's what its assistance has had. It gets from one and then carries on to the next. Each of them are doing their job. And with the COVID thing, and I put Sabine on to Dr. Bean, and I see you've got an interview coming up with Dr. Mabine, it's going to be on there soon. So I look forward to that, Sabine, I tell you. And he's very much onto this stool samples of children. And the other thing that Sabine has discovered is the amount, or her and her group, the amount of ACE2 receptors that are in the colon. Everyone talks about them, you know, there's here and there and different organs and whatever, but there's multitudes of them in the colon. So they're there as ready and willing, you know, subjects for the spike protein to adhere to. So if we can occupy them or give them some friendly help, then we might not get this great overload infection down there and cause this long COVID or add to this long COVID or stop our recovery. So there's plenty in this that just needs more research.
Sabine, how do we best protect ourselves in this world of viruses and bacteria, particularly if we're likely to see lab-created, which are unnatural pathogens?
Well, I think our bodies have the ability to reject unnatural things to begin with. So the body, you know, when something enters it, it creates an immune response to reject that that microbe or that toxic intake that you've gotten. So that's the first thing. You got to trust your body. Obviously, not everybody has the right microbiome. Not everybody has the right health. Some people have abused their bodies, you know, the people that overdrank, overused drugs, overused antibiotics, overate the donuts and the French fries and all that. And unfortunately, so that's the first step, is basically protect yourself by changing your habits, right? I mean, we all know that a healthy diet and exercise is good for you, right? You're happier when you exercise, you're happier when you're lighter, you're more miserable when you've gained weight. So I think that's the first thing. The second thing is, you know, we tend to forget about nutrition. You know, these microbes need nutrients. You know, they need the vitamin C. They need the vitamin D. They need, we're coming out with a paper actually that shows how vitamin C improves the microbiome. You know, I think that's the first thing. You know, make sure your vitamin D level is right. You know, plants need oxygen. They need sun. Human beings need oxygen and sun and water. You know, we're not that much different than any other living, you know, organs, except we're a little bit more complex because we're a reservoir of all these microbes that are all doing these things. And, you know, you guys talk about like one bacteria helping another and another, you know, and if one bacteria is damaged, then the other one and the other one, it's a domino effect, right? I like to think of the microbiome like a transmission of a car, you know, the transmission of a car. And I think Elon Musk would appreciate that. A transmission of a car is essentially like that log in the toilet. But when you break down the transmission of a car, it's actually 880 pieces. Nobody really knows that. Now, if one piece of the transmission is broken, the whole transmission is broken. You can't fix that. Now, you can try to fix that piece, but you'll keep on breaking another piece by trying to fix it. So at the end, you're going to need to change the transmission no matter what, because you fixed that little one piece of the transmission. Now, are you going to put the transmission of a Honda into a Mercedes? No. And that's essentially what fecal transplant to me is. It's about the right microbiome to implant back into a human. And those are the discoveries. So when you talk about nutrients, is very important to the microbiome. Most importantly, stopping the killing. Stop the stress, stop the anxiety, you know, calm down the body, stop the thinking about death constantly, turn off the TV, turn off the monkeypox, who cares? Three people got it. Start focusing on living and not fearing to live. And that's the problem right now, is we're listening to so much of a narrative that is just putting us at fear, because then they can sell us, because we're in fear constantly. So they can sell you the mask, they can sell you the new test, They can sell you the new meds. They can sell you the new vaccine. We got to stop the fear, and we got to stop becoming consumers to that narrative and just shut it off and start thinking of yourself. You're in this planet to enjoy the planet, to give back to the planet, to help those that are unfortunate, and to basically breathe and appreciate life. Once you start doing that and you turn off, you're going to start becoming at peace. And then you change your nutrition. So nutrition, you know, vitamin C, D, zinc is important. Mm-hmm. You know, yogurts. I'm a very, very big pusher of homemade yogurts. Regenerative farming. Use a farm that doesn't use pesticides, that doesn't use antibiotics in their cow's meat, and that actually incorporate all the animals together. The chicken needs the poop of the cow. The cow needs the poop of the chicken. You know, it's all intermingling. That's the beauty of regenerative farming. Mm. That's the beauty of the foods from regenerative farms. You know, eat as natural as possible.
Yep.
Avoid things that have pesticides, salads, anything that's, you know, outside. You know, stick to fruits that are like covered, bananas, coconut, pineapple,
just
potatoes.
Just common sense. It's fantastic. We have to go. We're going up to the news. Dr. Sabine Hazan and John Parsons, thank you very much.